tone, starve, work like slaves, send their kids to the reaping. You haven't hurt people. You've given them an opportunity. They just have to be brave enough to take it. There's already been talk in the mines. People who want to fight. Don't you see? It's happening. It's finally happening. If there's an uprising in District 8, why not here? Why not everywhere? This could be it. The thing we've been...
Stop it! You don't know what you're saying. The peacekeepers outside of 12, they're not like Darius or even Cray. The lives of district people, they mean less than nothing to them, I say.
That's why we have to join the fight, he answers harshly.
No, we have to leave here before they kill us and a lot of other people too.
I'm yelling again, but I can't understand why he's doing this. Why doesn't he see what's so undeniable?
Gale pushes me roughly away from him. You leave, then. I'd never go in a million years.
You were happy enough to go before. I don't see how an uprising in District 8 does anything but make it more important that we leave. You're just mad about...
No, I can't throw Peter in his face.
What about your family?
What about the other families, Katniss? The ones who can't run away. Don't you see? It can't be about just saving us anymore. Not if the rebellion's begun.
Gale shakes his head, not hiding his disgust with me.
You could do so much.
He throws Cinna's gloves at my feet.
I changed my mind. I don't want anything they made in the capital.
And he's gone. I look down at the gloves. Anything they made in the capital? Was that directed at me? Does he think I am now just another product of the capital and therefore something untouchable? The unfairness of it all fills me with rage. But it's mixed up with fear over what kind of crazy thing he might do next. I sink down next to the fire, desperate for comfort, to work out my next move. I calm myself by thinking that rebellions don't happen in a day. Gale can't talk to the miners until tomorrow. If I can get to Hazel before then, she might straighten him out. But I can't go now. If he's there, he'll lock me out. Maybe tonight, after everyone else is asleep. Hazel often works late into the night finishing up laundry. I could go then, tap at the window, tell her the situation, so she'll keep Gale from doing anything foolish. My conversation with President Snow in the study comes back to me.
My advisors were concerned you would be difficult, but you're not planning on being difficult at all, are you?
No.
That's what I told them. I said any girl who goes to such lengths to preserve her life isn't going to be interested in throwing it away with both hands.
I think of how hard Hazel has worked to keep that family alive. Surely she'll be on my side in this matter. Or won't she? It must be getting on toward noon now, and the days are so short. No point in being in the woods after dark if you don't have to. I stamp out the remains of my little fire, clear up the scraps of food, and tuck Cinna's gloves in my belt. I guess I'll hang on to them for a while, in case Gale has a change of heart. I think of the look on his face when he flung them to the ground. How repelled he was by them. By me. I trudge through the woods and reach my old house while there's still light. My conversation with Gale was an obvious setback, but I'm still determined to carry on with my plan to escape District 12. I decide to find Peter next. In a strange way, since he's seen some of what I've seen on the tour, he may be an easier sell than Gale was. I run into him as he's leaving the Victor's village.
"Been hunting?" he asks.
You can see he doesn't think it's a good idea. "Not really. Going to town?" I ask.
"Yes, I'm supposed to eat dinner with my family," he says.
"Well, I can at least walk with you." The road from the Victor's village to the square gets little use. It's a safe enough place to talk, but I can't seem to get the words out. Proposing it to Gale was such a disaster. I gnaw on my chapped lips. The square gets closer with every step.
I may not have an opportunity again soon. I take a deep breath and let the words rush out.
Peeta, if I asked you to run away from the district with me, would you?
Peeta takes my arm, bringing me to a stop. He doesn't need to check my face to see if I'm serious.
Depends on why you're asking.
President Snow wasn't convinced by me. There's an uprising in District 8. We have to get out, I say.
By we, do you mean just you and me?
No.
Who else would be going? He asks.
My family? Yours? If they want to come? Haymitch, maybe? I say.
What about Gale? He says.
I don't know. He might have other plans, I say.
Peeta shakes his head and gives me a rueful smile.
I bet he does. Sure, Katniss. I'll go.
I feel a slight twinge of hope. You will?
Yeah, but I don't think for a minute you will, he says.
I jerk my arm away. Then you don't know me. Be ready. It could be any time.
I take off walking, and he follows a pace or two behind.
Katniss, Peeta says.
I don't slow down. If he thinks it's a bad idea, I don't want to know because it's the only one I have.
Katniss, hold up.
I kick a dirty frozen chunk of snow off the path and let him catch up. The coal dust makes everything look especially ugly.
I really will go if you want me to. I just think we better talk it through with Haymitch. Make sure we won't be making things worse for everyone.
He raises his head.
What's that?
I lift my chin. I've been so consumed with my own worries, I haven't noticed the strange noise coming from the square. A whistling, the sound of an impact, the intake of breath from a crowd.
Come on, Peeta says, his face suddenly hard.
I don't know why. I can't place the sound, even guess at the situation. But it means something bad to him. When we reach the square, it's clear something's happening, but the crowd's too thick to see. Peeta steps up on a crate against the wall of the sweet shop and offers me a hand while he scans the square. I'm halfway up when he suddenly blocks my way.
Get down. Get out of here.
He's whispering, but his voice is harsh with insistence.
What?
I say, trying to force my way back up.
Go home, Katniss. I'll be there in a minute, I swear, he says.
Whatever it is, it's terrible. I yank away from his hand and begin to push my way through the crowd. People see me, recognize my face, and then look panicked. Hands shove me back, voices hiss.
Get out of here, girl! Only make it worse! What do you want to do, get him killed?
But at this point, my heart is beating so fast and fierce, I hardly hear them. I only know that whatever waits in the middle of the square is meant for me. When I finally break through to the cleared space, I see I am right. And Peeta was right. And those voices were right, too.
Gale's wrists are bound to a wooden post. The wild turkey he shot earlier hangs above him, the nail driven through its neck. His jacket's been cast aside on the ground, his shirt torn away. He slumps unconscious on his knees, held up only by the ropes at his wrists. What used to be his back is a raw, bloody slab of meat. Standing behind him is a man I've never seen, but I recognize his uniform. It's the one designated for our head peacekeeper. This isn't old Cray, though. This is a tall, muscular man with sharp creases in his pants. The pieces of the picture do not quite come together until I see his arm raise the whip.
Chapter 8
No!
I cry and spring forward. It's too late to stop the arm from descending, and I instinctively know I won't have the power to block it. Instead, I throw myself directly between the whip and Gale. I've flung out my arms to protect as much of his broken body as possible, so there's nothing to deflect the lash. I take the full force of it across the left side of my face. The pain is blinding and instantaneous. Jagged flashes of light cross my vision, and I fall to my knees. One hand cups my cheek, while the other keeps me from tipping over. I can already feel the welt rising up, the swelling closing my eye. The stones beneath me are wet with Gale's blood, the air heavy with its scent. "Stop it! You'll kill him!" I shriek. I get a glimpse of my assailant's face. Hard, with deep lines, a cruel mouth. Gray hair shaved almost to non-existence, eyes so black they seem all pupils, a long, straight nose reddened by the freezing air. The powerful arm lifts again, his sights set on me. My hand flies to my shoulder, hungry for an arrow, but of course my weapons are stashed in the woods. I grit my teeth in anticipation of the next lash.
"Hold it!"
a voice barks. Haymitch appears and trips over a peacekeeper lying on the ground. It's Darius. A huge purple lump pushes through the red hair on his forehead. He's knocked out, but still breathing. What happened? Did he try to come to Gale's aid before I got here? Haymitch ignores him and pulls me to my feet roughly.
"Oh, excellent!"
His hand locks under my chin, lifting it. "She's got a photo shoot next week modeling wedding dresses. What am I supposed to tell her stylist?" I see a flicker of recognition in the eyes of the man with the whip. Bundled against the cold, my face free of makeup, my braid tucked carelessly under my coat, it wouldn't be easy to identify me as the victor of the last Hunger Games. Especially with half my face swelling up. But Haymitch has been showing up on television for years, and he'd be difficult to forget. The man rests the whip on his hip.
"She interrupted the punishment of a confessed criminal."
Everything about this man, his commanding voice, his odd accent, warns of an unknown and dangerous threat. Where has he come from? District 11? 3? From the Capitol itself?
"I don't care if she blew up the blasted Justice Building. Look at her cheek. Think that will be camera ready in a week?"
Haymitch snarls. The man's voice is still cold, but I can detect a slight edge of doubt.
"That's not my problem." "No. Well, it's about to be, my friend. The first call I make when I get home is to the Capitol," says Haymitch. "Find out who authorized you to mess up my victor's pretty little face." "He was poaching. What business is it of hers, anyway?" says the man.
"He's her cousin. Peeta's got my other arm now, but gently. And she's my fiancé, so if you want to get to him, expect to go through both of us. Maybe we're it, the only three people in the district who could make a stand like this. Although it's sure to be temporary. There will be repercussions, but at the moment, all I care about is keeping Gale alive." The new head peacekeeper glances over at his backup squad. With relief, I see their familiar faces, old friends from the Hob. You can tell by their expressions that they're not enjoying the show. One, a woman named Pernia, who eats regularly at Greasy Say's, steps forward stiffly.
"I believe, for a first offense, the required number of lashes has been dispensed, sir, unless your sentence is death, which we would carry out by firing squad." "Is that the standard protocol here?" asks the head peacekeeper.
"Yes, sir," Pernia says, and several others nod in agreement. I'm sure none of them actually know, because in the Hob, the standard protocol for someone showing up with a wild turkey is for everybody to bid on the drumsticks.
"Very well. Get your cousin out of here then, girl. And if he comes too, Remind him that the next time he poaches off the capital's land, I'll assemble the firing squad personally.
The head peacekeeper wipes his hand along the length of the whip, splattering us with blood. Then he coils it into quick, neat loops and walks off. Most of the other peacekeepers fall in an awkward formation behind him. A small group stays behind and hoists Darius's body up by the arms and legs. I catch Pernia's eye and mouth the words, "Thanks," before she goes. She doesn't respond, but I'm sure she understood.
"Gail?"
I turn my hands, fumbling at the knots binding his wrists. Someone passes forward a knife, and Peter cuts the ropes. Gail collapses to the ground.
"Better get him to your mother," says Haymitch.
There's no stretcher, but the old woman at the clothing stall sells us the board that serves as her countertop.
"Just don't tell where you got it," she says, packing up the rest of her goods quickly.
Most of the square is emptied, fear getting the better of compassion. But after what just happened, I can't blame anyone. By the time we've laid Gale face down on the board, there's only a handful of people left to carry him. Haymitch, Peter, and a couple of miners who work on the same crew as Gale lift him up. Levy, a girl who lives a few houses down from mine in the seam, takes my arm. My mother kept her little brother alive last year when he caught the measles.
"Need help getting back?"
Her gray eyes are scared but determined.
"No, but can you get Hazel? Send her over?"
I ask.
"Yeah,"
says Levy, turning on her heel.
"Levy," I say, "don't let her bring the kids."
"No, I'll stay with them myself,"
she says.
"Thanks."
I grab Gail's jacket and hurry after the others.
"Get some snow on that,"
Haymitch orders over his shoulder. I scoop up a handful of snow and press it against my cheek, numbing a bit of the pain. My left eye's tearing heavily now, and in the dimming light it's all I can do to follow the boots in front of me. As we walk, I hear Bristol and Tom, Gale's crewmates, piece together the story of what happened. Gale must have gone to Cray's house, as he's done 100 times, knowing Cray always pays well for a wild turkey. Instead, he found the new head peacekeeper, a man they heard someone call Romulus Thread. No one knows what happened to Cray. He was buying white liquor in the hob just this morning, apparently still in command of the district, but now he's nowhere to be found. Thread put Gale under immediate arrest, and of course, since he was standing there holding a dead turkey, there was little Gale could say in his own defense. Word of his predicament spread quickly. He was brought to the square, forced to plead guilty to his crime, and sentenced to a whipping to be carried out immediately. By the time I showed up, he'd been lashed at least 40 times. He passed out around 30.
"Lucky he only had the turkey on him," says Bristol. "If he'd had his usual haul, would have been much worse."
"He told Thread he found it wandering around the seam, said it got over the fence, and he'd stabbed it with a stick. Still a crime, but if they'd known he'd been in the woods with weapons, they'd have killed him for sure," says Tom.
"What about Darius?" Peter asks.
"After about 20 lashes, he stepped in, saying that was enough. Only he didn't do it smart and official, like Pernia did. He grabbed Thread's arm, and Thread hit him in the head with the butt of the whip. Nothing good waiting for him," says Bristol.
"Doesn't sound like much good for any of us," says Haymitch.
Snow begins, thick and wet, making visibility even more difficult. I stumble up the walk to my house behind the others, using my ears more than my eyes to guide me. A golden light colors the snow as the door opens. My mother, who was no doubt waiting for me after a long day of unexplained absence, takes in the scene.
"New head,"
Haymitch says, and she gives him a curt nod, as if no other explanation is needed. I'm filled with awe, as I always am, as I watch her transform from a woman who calls me to kill a spider to a woman immune to fear. When a sick or dying person is brought to her, this is the only time I think my mother knows who she is. In moments, the long kitchen table has been cleared, a sterile white cloth spread across it, and Gail hoisted onto it. My mother pours water from a kettle into a basin while ordering Prim to pull a series of her remedies from the medicine cabinet. Dried herbs and tinctures and store-bought bottles. I watch her hands, the long, tapered fingers, crumbling this, adding drops of that into the basin, soaking a cloth in the hot liquid as she gives Prim instructions to prepare a second brew. My mother glances my way. "Did it cut your eye?"
"No, it's just swelled shut," I say.
"Get more snow on it," she instructs, but I am clearly not a priority.
"Can you save him?"
I ask my mother. She says nothing as she wrings out the cloth and holds it in the air to cool somewhat.
"Don't worry," says Hamish. "Used to be a lot of whipping before Cray. She's the one we took them to."
I can't remember a time before Cray, a time when there was a head peacekeeper who used the whip freely. But my mother must have been around my age and still working at the apothecary shop with her parents. Even back then, she must have had healer's hands. Ever so gently, she begins to clean the mutilated flesh on Gail's back. I feel sick to my stomach, useless, the remaining snow dripping from my glove into a puddle on the floor. Peeta puts me in a chair and holds a cloth filled with fresh snow to my cheek. Hamish tells Bristol and Tom to get home, and I see him press coins into their hands before they leave.
"Don't know what will happen with your crew," he says.
They nod and accept the money.
Hazel arrives, breathless and flushed, fresh snow in her hair. Wordlessly, she sits on a stool next to the table, takes Gail's hand, and holds it against her lips. My mother doesn't acknowledge even her. She's gone into that special zone that includes only herself and the patient and occasionally Prim. The rest of us can wait. Even in her expert hands, it takes a long time to clean the wounds, arrange what shredded skin can be saved, apply a salve and a light bandage. As the blood clears, I can see where every stroke of the lash landed and feel it resonate in the single cut on my face. I multiply my own pain once, twice, 40 times, and can only hope that Gail remains unconscious. Of course, that's too much to ask for. As the final bandages are being placed, a moan escapes his lips. Hazel strokes his hair and whispers something while my mother and Prim go through their meager store of painkillers, the kind usually accessible only to doctors. They're hard to come by, expensive, and always in demand. My mother has to save the strongest for the worst pain. But what is the worst pain? To me, it's always the pain that is present. If I were in charge, those painkillers would be gone in a day, because I have so little ability to watch suffering. My mother tries to save them for those who are actually in the process of dying, to ease them out of the world. Since Gail is regaining consciousness, they decide on an herbal concoction he can take by mouth. "That won't be enough,"
I say. They stare at me.
"That won't be enough. I know how it feels. That will barely knock out a headache."
"We'll combine it with sleep syrup, Katniss, and he'll manage it. The herbs are more for the inflammation," my mother begins calmly.
"Just give him the medicine,"
I scream at her.
"Give it to him. Who are you, anyway, to decide how much pain he can stand?"
Gail begins stirring at my voice, trying to reach me. The movement causes fresh blood to stain his bandages and an agonized sound to come from his mouth. "Take her out," says my mother. Hamish and Peeta literally carry me from the room while I shout obscenities at her. They pin me down on a bed in one of the extra bedrooms until I stop fighting. While I lie there, sobbing, tears trying to squeeze out of the slit of my eye, I hear Peeta whisper to Hamish about President Snow, about the uprising in District 8. She wants us all to run, he says. But if Haymitch has an opinion on this, he doesn't offer it. After a while, my mother comes in and treats my face. Then she holds my hand, stroking my arm, while Haymitch fills her in on what happened with Gale. So it's starting again, she says, like before.
By the looks of it, he answers. Who'd have thought we'd ever be sorry to see old Cray go?
Cray would have been disliked anyway, because of the uniform he wore. But it was his habit of luring starving young women into his bed for money that made him an object of loathing in the district. In really bad times, the hungriest would gather at his door at nightfall, vying for the chance to earn a few coins to feed their families by selling their bodies. Had I been older when my father died, I might have been among them. Instead, I learned to hunt. I don't know exactly what my mother means by things starting again, but I'm too angry and hurting to ask. It's registered, though, the idea of worse times returning, because when the doorbell rings, I shoot straight out of bed. Who could it be at this hour of the night? There's only one answer. Peacekeepers. They can't have him, I say.
Might be you thereafter, Haymitch reminds me.
Or you, I say.
Not my house, Haymitch points out, but I'll get the door.
No, I'll get it, says my mother quietly. We all go, though, following her down the hallway to the insistent ring of the bell. When she opens it, there's not a squad of peacekeepers, but a single snow-caked figure. Madge. She holds out a small, damp cardboard box to me. Use this on your friend, she says. I take off the lid of the box, revealing half a dozen vials of clear liquid. They're my mother's. She said I could take them. Use them, please. She runs back into the storm before we can stop her.
Crazy girl,
Haymitch mutters as we follow my mother into the kitchen. Whatever my mother had given Gale, I was right. It isn't enough. His teeth are gritted and his flesh shines with sweat. My mother fills a syringe with the clear liquid from one of the vials and shoots it into his arm. Almost immediately, his face begins to relax.
What is that stuff? Asks Peter.
It's from the capital. It's called morphling, my mother answers.
I didn't even know Madge knew Gale, says Peter.
We used to sell her strawberries, I say almost angrily. What am I angry about, though? Not that she has brought the medicine, surely.
She must have quite a taste for them, says Haymitch.
That's what nettles me. It's the implication that there's something going on between Gale and Madge, and I don't like it. She's my friend, is all I say. Now that Gale has drifted away on the painkiller, everyone seems to deflate. Prim makes us each eat some stew and bread. A room is offered to Hazel, but she has to go home to the other kids. Haymitch and Peter are both willing to stay, but my mother sends them home to bed as well. She knows it's pointless to try this with me, and leaves me to tend to Gale while she and Prim rest. Alone in the kitchen with Gale, I sit on Hazel's stool, holding his hand. After a while, my fingers find his face. I touch parts of him I've never had cause to touch before. His heavy, dark eyebrows, the curve of his cheek, the line of his nose, the hollow at the base of his neck. I trace the outline of stubble on his jaw and finally work my way to his lips. Soft and full, slightly chapped. His breath warms my chilled skin. Does everyone look younger asleep? Because right now he could be the boy I ran into in the woods years ago, the one who accused me of stealing from his traps. What a pair we were, fatherless, frightened, but fiercely committed to keeping our families alive. Desperate, yet no longer alone after that day, because we'd found each other. I think of 100 moments in the woods Lazy afternoons, fishing. The day I taught him to swim. That time I twisted my knee and he carried me home. Mutually counting on each other, watching each other's backs, forcing each other to be brave. For the first time, I reverse our positions in my head. I imagine watching Gale volunteering to save Rory in the reaping, having him torn from my life, becoming some strange girl's lover to stay alive, and then coming home with her, living next to her, promising to marry her. The hatred I feel for him, for the phantom girl, for everything is so real and immediate that it chokes me. Gale is mine. I am his. Anything else is unthinkable. Why did it take him being whipped within an inch of his life to see it? Because I'm selfish. I'm a coward. I'm the kind of girl who, when she might actually be of use, would run to stay alive and leave those who couldn't follow to suffer and die. This is the girl Gale met in the woods today. No wonder I won the games. No decent person ever does. You saved Peter, I think, weakly. But now I question even that. I knew good and well that my life back in District 12 would have been unlivable if I let that boy die. I rest my head forward on the edge of the table, overcome with loathing for myself, wishing I had died in the arena, wishing Seneca Crane had blown me to bits the way President Snow said he should have when I held out the berries. The berries. I realize the answer to who I am lies in that handful of poisonous fruit. If I held them out to save Peter because I knew I would be shunned if I came back without him, then I am despicable. If I held them out because I loved him, I'm still self-centered, although forgivable. But if I held them out to defy the capital, I am someone of worth. The trouble is, I don't know exactly what was going on inside me at that moment. Could it be the people in the districts are right? That it was an act of rebellion, even if it was an unconscious one? Because deep down, I must know it isn't enough to keep myself or my family or my friends alive by running away. Even if I could, it wouldn't fix anything. It wouldn't stop people from being hurt the way Gale was today. Life in District 12 isn't really so different from life in the arena. At some point, you have to stop running and turn around and face whoever wants you dead. The hard thing is finding the courage to do it. Well, it's not hard for Gale. He was born a rebel. I'm the one making an escape plan. "I'm so sorry," I whisper. I lean forward and kiss him. His eyelashes flutter, and he looks at me through a haze of opiates. "Hey, Catnip."
"Hey, Gale," I say.
"Thought you'd be gone by now," he says. My choices are simple. I can die like Quarry in the woods, or I can die here beside Gale.
"I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay right here and cause all kinds of trouble."
"Me too," Gale says.
He just manages a smile before the drugs pull him back under.
Chapter 9. Someone gives my shoulder a shake and I sit up. I've fallen asleep with my face on the table. The white cloth has left creases on my good cheek. The other, the one that took the lash from Thread, throbs painfully. Gale's dead to the world, but his fingers are locked around mine. I smell fresh bread and turn my stiff neck to find Peter looking down at me with such a sad expression. I get the sense that he's been watching us a while.
"Go on up to bed, Katniss. I'll look after him now," he says.
"Peter, about what I said yesterday, about running," I begin.
"I know," he says. "There's nothing to explain."
I see the loaves of bread on the counter in the pale, snowy morning light, the blue shadows under his eyes. I wonder if he slept at all. Couldn't have been long. I think of his agreeing to go with me yesterday,
his stepping up beside me to protect Gale, his willingness to throw his lot in with mine entirely when I give him so little in return. No matter what I do, I'm hurting someone.
Peeta,
just go to bed, okay? He says. I feel my way up the stairs, crawl under the covers, and fall asleep at once. At some point, Clove, the girl from District 2, enters my dreams. She chases me, pins me to the ground, and pulls out a knife to cut my face. It digs deeply into my cheek, opening a wide gash. Then Clove begins to transform, her face elongating into a snout, dark fur sprouting from her skin, her fingernails growing into long claws, but her eyes remain unchanged. She becomes the mutation form of herself, the wolf-like creation of the capital that terrorized us the last night in the arena. Tossing back her head, she lets out a long, eerie howl that is picked up by other mutts nearby. Clove begins to lap the blood flowing from my wound, each lick sending a new wave of pain through my face. I give a strangled cry and wake with a start, sweating and shivering at once. Cradling my damaged cheek in my hand, I remind myself that it was not Clove, but Thread who gave me this wound. I wish that Peeta were here to hold me, until I remember I'm not supposed to wish that anymore. I have chosen Gale and the Rebellion, and a future with Peeta is the Capital's design, not mine. The swelling around my eye has gone down, and I can open it a bit. I push aside the curtains and see the snowstorm has strengthened to a full-out blizzard. There's nothing but whiteness and the howling wind that sounds remarkably like the mutations. I welcome the blizzard, with its ferocious winds and deep drifting snow. This may be enough to keep the real wolves, also known as the peacekeepers, from my door. A few days to think, to work out a plan. With Gale and Peeta and Haymitch all at hand, this blizzard is a gift. Before I go down to face this new life, though, I take some time making myself acknowledge what it will mean. Less than a day ago, I was prepared to head into the wilderness with my loved ones in midwinter, with the very real possibility of the capital pursuing us. A precarious venture at best, but now I am committing to something even more risky. Fighting the capital assures their swift retaliation. I must accept that at any moment I can be arrested. There will be a knock on the door, like the one last night, a band of peacekeepers to haul me away. There might be torture, mutilation, a bullet through my skull in the town square if I am fortunate enough to go that quickly. The capital has no end of creative ways to kill people. I imagine these things and I'm terrified, but let's face it, they've been lurking in the back of my brain anyway. I've been a tribute in the games, been threatened by the president, taken a lash across my face. I'm already a target. Now comes the harder part. I have to face the fact that my family and friends might share this fate. Prim. I need only to think of Prim and all my resolve disintegrates. It's my job to protect her. I pull the blanket up over my head, and my breathing is so rapid I use up all the oxygen and begin to choke for air. I can't let the capital hurt Prim. And then it hits me. They already have. They have killed her father in those wretched mines. They have sat by as she almost starved to death. They have chosen her as a tribute, then made her watch her sister fight to the death in the games. She has been hurt far worse than I had at the age of 12, and even that pales in comparison with Rue's life. I shove off the blanket and suck in the cold air that seeps through the window panes. Prim, Rue, aren't they the very reason I have to try to fight? Because what has been done to them is so wrong, so beyond justification, so evil that there is no choice. Because no one has the right to treat them as they have been treated? Yes, this is the thing to remember when fear threatens to swallow me up. What I am about to do,
Whatever any of us are forced to endure, it is for them. It's too late to help Rue, but maybe not too late for those 5 little faces that looked up at me from the square in District 11. Not too late for Rory and Vic and Posey. Not too late for Prim. Gale is right. If people have the courage, this could be an opportunity. He's also right that since I have set it in motion, I could do so much. Although I have no idea what exactly that should be. But deciding not to run away is a crucial first step. I take a shower, and this morning my brain is not assembling lists of supplies for the wild, but trying to figure out how they organize that uprising in District 8. So many, so clearly acting in defiance of the capital. Was it even planned, or something that simply erupted out of years of hatred and resentment? How could we do that here? Would the people of District 12 join in or lock their doors? Yesterday the square emptied so quickly after Gale's whipping. But isn't that because we all feel so impotent and have no idea what to do? We need someone to direct us and reassure us this is possible. And I don't think I'm that person. I may have been a catalyst for rebellion, but a leader should be someone with conviction, and I'm barely a convert myself. Someone with unflinching courage, and I'm still working hard at even finding mine. Someone with clear and persuasive words, and I'm so easily tongue-tied. Words. I think of words, and I think of Peter, how people embrace everything he says. He could move a crowd to action, I bet, if he chose to. Would find the things to say, but I'm sure the idea has never crossed his mind. Downstairs I find my mother and Prim tending to a subdued Gale. The medicine must be wearing off by the look on his face. I brace myself for another fight, but try to keep my voice calm. Can't you give him another shot? I will, if it's needed. We thought we'd try the snow coat first, says my mother. She has removed his bandages. You can practically see the heat radiating off his back. She lays a clean cloth across his angry flesh and nods to Prim. Prim comes over, stirring what appears to be a large bowl of snow. But it's tinted a light green and gives off a sweet, clean scent. Snow coat. She carefully begins to ladle the stuff onto the cloth. I can almost hear the sizzle of Gale's tormented skin meeting the snow mixture. His eyes flutter open, perplexed, and then he lets out a sound of relief. It's lucky we have snow, says my mother. I think of what it must be like to recover from a whipping in midsummer with the searing heat and the tepid water from the tap. What did you do in warm months? I ask. A crease appears between my mother's eyebrows as she frowns. Tried to keep the flies away. My stomach turns at the thought. She fills a handkerchief with the snow coat mixture, and I hold it to the wheel on my cheek. Instantly the pain withdraws. It's the coldness of the snow, yes, but whatever mix of herbal juices my mother has added numbs as well. Oh, that's wonderful. Why didn't you put this on him last night? I needed the wound to set first, she says. I don't know what that means exactly, but as long as it works, who am I to question her? She knows what she's doing, my mother. I feel a pang of remorse about yesterday. The awful things I yelled at her as Peter and Haymitch dragged me from the kitchen. I'm sorry about screaming at you yesterday. I've heard worse, she says. You've seen how people are when someone they love is in pain. Someone they love. The words numb my tongue as if it's been packed in snow coat. Of course, I love Gale. But what kind of love does she mean? What do I mean when I say I love Gale? I don't know. I did kiss him last night, in a moment when my emotions were running so high, but I'm sure he doesn't remember it, does he? I hope not. If he does, everything will just get more complicated,
and I really can't think about kissing when I've got a rebellion to incite. I give my head a little shake to clear it.
Where's Peter? I say.
He went home when we heard you stirring. Didn't want to leave his house unattended during the storm, says my mother.
Did he get back all right?
I ask. In a blizzard, you can get lost in a matter of yards and wander off course into oblivion. Why don't you give him a call and check? She says. I go into the study, a room I've pretty much avoided since my meeting with President Snow, and dial Peter's number. After a few rings, he answers.
Hey, I just wanted to make sure you got home, I say.
Katniss, I live 3 houses away from you, he says.
I know, but with the weather and all, I say.
Well, I'm fine. Thank you for checking. There's a long pause. How's Gail?
All right. My mother and Prim are giving him snow coat now, I say.
And your face? He asks.
I've got some, too, I say. Have you seen Haymitch today?
I checked in on him, dead drunk, but I built up his fire and left him some bread, he says.
I wanted to talk to both of you.
I don't dare add more here on my phone, which is surely tapped. Probably have to wait until after the weather calms down, he says. Nothing much will happen before that, anyway.
No, nothing much, I agree. It takes 2 days for the storm to blow itself out, leaving us with drifts higher than my head. Another day before the path is cleared from the Victor's village to the square. During this time I help tend to Gale, apply snow coat to my cheek, try to remember everything I can about the uprising in District 8, in case it will help us. The swelling in my face goes down, leaving me with an itchy, healing wound and a very black eye. But still, the first chance I get, I call Peter to see if he wants to go into town with me. We rouse Haymitch and drag him along with us. He complains, but not as much as usual. We all know we need to discuss what happened, and it can't be anywhere as dangerous as our homes in the Victor's village. In fact, we wait until the village is well behind us to even speak. I spend the time studying the 10-foot walls of snow piled up on either side of the narrow path that has been cleared, wondering if they will collapse in on us. Finally, Haymitch breaks the silence.
So, we're all heading off into the great unknown, are we? He asks me.
No, I say, not anymore.
Worked through the flaws in that plan, did you, sweetheart? He asks. Any new ideas?
I want to start an uprising, I say.
Haymitch just laughs. It's not even a mean laugh, which is more troubling. It shows he can't even take me seriously.
Well, I want a drink. You let me know how that works out for you, though, he says.
Then what's your plan? I spit back at him.
My plan is to make sure everything is just perfect for your wedding, says Haymitch. I called and rescheduled the photo shoot without giving too many details.
You don't even have a phone, I say.
Effie had that fixed, he says. Do you know she asked me if I'd like to give you away? I told her the sooner the better.
Haymitch, I can hear the pleading creeping into my voice.
Katniss, he mimics my tone.
It won't work.
We shut up as a team of men with shovels passes us, headed out to the Victor's village. Maybe they can do something about those 10-foot walls. And by the time they're out of earshot, the square is too close. We step into it and all come to a stop simultaneously. Nothing much will happen during the blizzard. That's what Peter and I had agreed, but we couldn't have been more wrong. The square has been transformed. A huge banner with the seal of Panem hangs off the roof of the Justice Building. Peacekeepers in pristine white uniforms march on the cleanly swept cobblestones. Along the rooftops, more of them occupy nests of machine guns. Most unnerving is a line of new constructions, an official whipping post, several stockades, and a gallows, set up in the center of the square.
Thread's a quick worker,
says Haymitch.
Some streets away from the square, I see a blaze flare up. None of us has to say it.
That can only be the hob going up in smoke.
I think of Greasy Say, Ripper, all my friends who make their living there.
Haymitch, you don't think everyone's still in?
I can't finish the sentence.
Nah, they're smarter than that. You'd be too if you'd been around longer, he says. Well, I better go see how much rubbing alcohol the apothecary can spare.
He trudges off across the square and I look at Peeta.
What's he want that for?
Then I realize the answer.
We can't let him drink it. He'll kill himself,
or at the very least go blind.
I've got some white liquor put away at home.
Me too. Maybe that will hold him until Ripper finds a way to be back in business, says Peeta.
I need to check on my family.
I have to go see Hazel. I'm worried now. I thought she'd be on our doorstep the moment the snow was cleared, but there's been no sign of her.
I'll go too. Drop by the bakery on my way home, he says.
Thanks. I'm suddenly very scared at what I might find. The streets are almost deserted, which would not be so unusual at this time of day if people were at the mines, kids at school, but they're not. I see faces peeking at us out of doorways, through cracks in shutters.
An uprising, I think.
What an idiot I am.
There's an inherent flaw in the plan that both Gale and I were too blind to see. An uprising requires breaking the law, thwarting authority. We've done that our whole lives, or our families have, poaching, trading on the black market, mocking the capital in the woods. But for most people in District 12, a trip to buy something at the hob would be too risky. And I expect them to assemble in the square with bricks and torches?
Even the sight of Peeta and me is enough to make people pull their children away from the windows and draw the curtains tightly. We find Hazel in her house, nursing a very sick posy. I recognize the measles spots.
I couldn't leave her, she says. I knew Gale'd be in the best possible hands.
Of course, I say. He's much better. My mother says he'll be back in the mines in a couple of weeks.
May not be open until then, anyway, says Hazel.
Word is they're closed until further notice.
She gives a nervous glance at her empty wash tub.
You closed down, too? I ask.
Not officially, says Hazel. But everyone's afraid to use me now.
Maybe it's the snow, says Peeta.
No, Rory made a quick round this morning. Nothing to wash, apparently, she says.
Rory wraps his arms around Hazel.
We'll be all right.
I take a handful of money from my pocket and lay it on the table. My mother will send something for Posy.
When we're outside, I turn to Peeta.
You go on back. I want to walk by the hob.
I'll go with you, he says.
No, I've dragged you into enough trouble, I tell him.
And avoiding a stroll by the hob, that's going to fix things for me?
He smiles and takes my hand. Together we wind through the streets of the seam until we reach the burning building. They haven't even bothered to leave peacekeepers around it. They know no one would try to save it. The heat from the flames melts the surrounding snow, and a black trickle runs across my shoes.
It's all that coal dust from the old days, I say.
It was in every crack and crevice, ground into the floorboards. It's amazing the place didn't go up before.
I want to check on Greasy Say.
Not today, Katniss. I don't think we'd be helping anyone by dropping in on them, he says.
We go back to the square. I buy some cakes from Peeta's father while they exchange small talk about the weather. No one mentions the ugly tools of torture, just yards from the front door. The last thing I notice as we leave the square is that I do not recognize even one of the peacekeeper's faces. As the days pass, things go from bad to worse. The mines stay shut for 2 weeks, and by that time, half of District 12 is starving. The number of kids signing up for tesseries soars, but they often don't receive their grain.
food shortages begin, and even those with money come away from stores empty-handed. When the mines reopen, wages are cut, hours extended, miners sent into blatantly dangerous work sites. The eagerly awaited food promised for parcel day arrives spoiled and defiled by rodents. The installations in the square see plenty of action as people are dragged in and punished for offenses so long overlooked we've forgotten they are illegal. Gail goes home with no more talk of rebellion between us. But I can't help thinking that everything he sees will only strengthen his resolve to fight back. The hardships in the mines, the tortured bodies in the square, the hunger on the faces of his family. Rory has signed up for Tesserae, something Gail can't even speak about, but it's still not enough with the inconsistent availability and the ever-increasing price of food. The only bright spot is, I get Haymitch to hire Hazel as a housekeeper, resulting in some extra money for her and greatly increasing Haymitch's standard of living. It's weird going into his house, finding it fresh and clean, food warming on the stove. He hardly notices because he's fighting a whole different battle. Peeta and I tried to ration what white liquor we had, but it's almost run out, and the last time I saw Ripper, she was in the stocks. I feel like a pariah when I walk through the streets. Everyone avoids me in public now, but there's no shortage of company at home. A steady supply of ill and injured is deposited in our kitchen before my mother, who has long since stopped charging for her services. Her stocks of remedies are running so low, though, that soon all she'll have to treat the patients with is snow. The woods, of course, are forbidden. Absolutely. No question. Even Gail doesn't challenge this now. But one morning, I do. And it isn't the house full of the sick and dying, the bleeding backs, the gaunt-faced children, the marching boots, or the omnipresent misery that drives me under the fence. It's the arrival of a crate of wedding dresses one night with a note from Effie saying that President Snow approved these himself. The wedding. Is he really planning to go through with it? What in his twisted brain will that achieve? Is it for the benefit of those in the capital? A wedding was promised, a wedding will be given, and then he'll kill us as a lesson to the districts? I don't know. I can't make sense of it. I toss and turn in bed until I can't stand it anymore. I have to get out of here, at least for a few hours. My hands dig around in my closet until I find the insulated winter gear Cinna made for me for recreational use on the Victory Tour. Waterproof boots, a snowsuit that covers me from head to toe, thermal gloves. I love my old hunting stuff, but the trek I have in mind today is more suited to this high-tech clothing. I tiptoe downstairs, load my game bag with food, and sneak out of the house. Slinking along the side streets and back alleys, I make my way to the weak spot in the fence closest to Ruba the Butcher's. Since many workers cross this way to get to the mines, the snow's pockmarked with footprints. Mine will not be noticed. With all his security upgrades, Thread has paid little attention to the fence, perhaps feeling harsh weather and wild animals are enough to keep everyone safely inside. Even so, once I'm under the chain link, I cover my tracks until the trees conceal them for me. Dawn is just breaking as I retrieve a set of bow and arrows and begin to force a path through the drifted snow in the woods. I'm determined, for some reason, to get to the lake. Maybe to say goodbye to the place, to my father, and the happy times we spent there, because I know I'll probably never return. Maybe just so I can draw a complete breath again. Part of me doesn't really care if they catch me, if I can see it one more time. The trip takes twice as long as usual. Cinna's clothes hold in the heat all right, and I arrive soaked with sweat under the snowsuit, while my face is numb with cold. The glare of the winter sun off the snow has played games with my vision, and I'm so exhausted and wrapped up in my own hopeless thoughts that I don't notice the signs. the thin stream of smoke from the chimney, the indentations of recent footprints, the smell of steaming pine needles,